welcome to the show, Joseph.
Oh, thank you for having me back, Whitley.
Well, it's a real pleasure, and I don't know if that's really the word. It's a little too scary to be an absolute pleasure, because I have a feeling that what we're talking about here is directly related to almost everything bizarre that is happening in our world. And as we said in the blurb about Dreamland, the last time you were interviewed by Jim, and at Reich of the Black Sun, we said, did the Nazis actually win World War II? And we just don't know it. And that reality is slowly emerging. I don't know. Jim, why don't we start off with you? And I'm going to just let you go hog wild with Joseph. I don't know where you're going to take him or where the two guys are going to go, but I'm just going to sit back and listen for this first segment. Jim, welcome to the show.
Yeah. Joseph, thank you so much for being on with us today. Correct me if I'm wrong, okay, but I think, you know, I'm sure the listeners are going, oh, this is incredible. Well, what is it? Tell me if this isn't kind of the bottom line. But the evidence that you've accumulated and that many other people have actually accumulated and written about since World War II comes down to this. We beat the German nation, but we didn't beat the Nazis. We just forced them to move. And a good portion of them came to the United States under Operation Paperclip, and then they were rolled into our national security apparatus, and then they are now kind of at the core of the national security state that an empire that the United States has become, but they're not operating, never have been totally operating on behalf of the United States. They have always kept their Nazi ideology. And that apparently things that are going on in the world even today can be traced back to these surviving Nazis and their proteges and the families who supported them in the war and support them to today. Is that a fair assessment?
Oh, absolutely, I think so. One of the things I do try and point out in the SS Brotherhood of the Bell, rather extensively, in fact, throughout the book, are the implications of the deal that Alan Dulles, who later became a CIA director, that he struck with the leader of German military intelligence on the Eastern Front, a German general by the name of Reinhard Gehlen. And most Americans don't know this story, but essentially what the deal was that we took over General Galen's very extensive military intelligence operation in Eastern Europe and inside of the Soviet Union, and basically rolled it into the OSS, which later became the CIA. Now, the implication of this is, very obviously, that even before President Truman had signed his name to the National Security Act of 1947, that the civilian charter of the CIA was already compromised, and compromised in a very, very significant way, in that the entire Soviet desk, for all operational purposes, was staffed by a bunch of Nazis. So yes, I think your assessment is quite true. We beat the German nation. But in point of fact, that really simply dispersed the Nazi Party elite and their scientific cadre around the world, and they managed to maneuver themselves into some very potent and powerful positions of influence.
So it certainly is now not any surprise that the United States and Soviet Russia were pitted against each other in a Cold War that lasted for 50 years, when you consider that all of the intelligence we were getting was coming from anti-communist underground filtered through a Nazi organization, right?
Right, exactly so, exactly so.
And no wonder we were so afraid of the Soviets.
Well, exactly, and you know, one of the things that an author by the name of Christopher Simpson has pointed out in an excellent study that he made of this whole thing, it's a book called Blowback, and that is that Galen's organization essentially overestimated, and deliberately did so, overestimated Soviet military potential after World War II, and essentially created the American policy of containment and ultimately the idea of a rollback by gradual stages of communism in its client states in Eastern Europe. So most of the Cold War ideology, in point of fact, as you have observed, is due to the creation of this intelligence analysis being done by a bunch of Nazis inside of the CIA.
Well, in fact, you know, you did not mention this in your book, but I've been doing radio programs all morning dealing with my new book on 9/11, and I think you'll back me up on this, that during World War II, the Nazis were very much working in league with a lot of the Arab states. In fact, it's my understanding that they helped create an entity known as the Muslim Brotherhood. So today I think that you could infer that perhaps the driving force behind the Arab terrorists today are actually the Muslims. I mean the Nazis.
Yes, in many instances this is true, because there was a considerable SS liaison between very radical Muslims prior to and during World War II. And that continued, incidentally, after the war, when you had various German experts going to Kamal Abdel Nasser's Egypt to provide them military assistance and so on and so forth. And in point of fact, one of the things I do observe in the book, very briefly, is that the Nazis established a connection with the notorious Egyptian radical Muslim by the name of Bana. And, of course, his whole career dovetails into all the other nasty sorts of radical Islamic sects that we are dealing with today. So there's another part of this story that you're quite right to observe, and that is we're seeing some long-term effects of this Nazi dispersal that occurred after the war.
That's true, and now this will probably is what would really pique Whitley's interest, is the fact that you go on to show that it is entirely probable that these Nazi scientists, who were the founders of our NASA space programs, may have indeed been working on the side on a totally separate parallel space program using very exotic technology.
Right.
Can you explain that a little bit?
Well, one of the things that I've always been fascinated by is all the various people that maintain that the Apollo moon missions were a hoax. Now, I'm definitely not of that camp. I definitely think that we went. However, they do present an interesting string of evidence to support their claims, and it is true that many of the pictures and so on and television broadcasts that we see from the moon present some highly anomalous things. And one of the things that always struck me was the LEM, the Lunar Excursion Module, taking off from the moon simply does not behave, in my opinion, like a rocket should. A rocket accelerates geometrically. It gathers speed, and it accelerates a little bit more per unit of time. Well, when we see the LEM taking off from the moon, it just sort of pops up at a more or less uniform rate of speed. Now, that always intrigued me, because it suggested to me, anyway, that there might be an alternative technology at work. And that, coupled with the fact that Wernher von Braun, about 2 weeks after the Apollo moon landing, let slip an interesting bit of information that the neutral point of gravity between the Earth and the moon was some 43,500-odd miles from the surface of the moon. Now, that's almost 20,000 miles further out than we had been previously reckoning by standard Newtonian calculations. And that means, essentially, that the moon is much more massive an object than we have been told. Now, it's interesting that shortly after von Braun let that remark slip, that he suddenly resigned all of his positions at NASA. And in the book, I speculate that one reason that he did so was that he let slip a data point that might indicate that there was an alternative technology involved. Because if the LEM was reliant solely upon rockets, as we've been told, to get it off the moon, then its much more massive gravity would simply make the LEM a kind of a ridiculous thing to get us off that if it was simply due to rockets. So
right.
I think
it wouldn't have enough thrust, right?
Right. It simply wouldn't have had enough thrust. So, in other words, I think what we're really looking at with the Apollo missions and some of the data that the people have pointed out as being suspicious is not that we didn't go,
Wendy, what do you think about that?
Well, what I think right now is that we're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we're going to get into the question of what that bell was and why Joseph thinks that there may have been technology involved in the moon landing, in the moon operation, that we aren't being told about, and that relates in an odd way to the hacker who has recently, in the process of being extradited to the United States, where he's going to be thrown in prison for the rest of his life, why the information he gave might be so of such incredible concern to all of the people keeping this secret. We'll be right back. Subscribers, don't miss the John Hoag interview this week, his latest prophecies, plus 9 to 10 a.m. Sunday. He's live in the subscriber chat room. And guess what? The 2007 Crop Circle calendars are in, and you get your 10% subscriber discount, so get one right away. Well, this is Whitley Strieber. It's Dreamland, and Joseph and I are going to take this segment together. Jim's going to jump in from time to time. And Jim and Joseph, listening to you and Jim talking about the moon lander, and I was reflecting on the fact that Buzz Aldrin recently admitted something rather strange. He said that he and the other astronauts on Apollo 11 on their way to the moon had seen an unknown object outside of the craft. He admitted this in a videotape, so I cannot be sued by him for saying that he said this, because he did say it, that they had seen something unusual, or that they couldn't identify, rather, outside of the Apollo 11 capsule on their way to the moon. And then a science director of NASA said in the same program that NASA had asked the astronauts not to talk about that, for any of this, for fear of ridicule, that NASA would be ridiculed. So there, it seems as if there was something about out there. Now we fast forward to the present, and we get to Gary McKinnon. Gary McKinnon, of course, he's been on Dreamland, and folks, you know who he is. He is the hacker who hacked into NASA's really non-secure elements of the NASA of NASA's network, and he found what he said, what I theorized at the time, might could have been lists for a video game. But the implications of the record that he saw were that there is a very large space force currently there in outer space. And Joseph addresses this directly in this phenomenal book, in The Brotherhood of the Bell. And Joseph, I would like you, if you could, to tell us, now we're going to get later, folks, into exactly what the bell is later in the show. But Joseph, if you could address for us why you think or theorize that McKinnon could conceivably be right.
Well, basically, it goes back to what I said in the previous segment. I think that there are so many anomalies that we encountered during the Apollo missions on the moon flights, not the least of which being the takeoff signature of the LEM just does not, to me, again, look like a rocket signature. So we are dealing with an off-the-books technology that we have not been told about. Now, as to what we may have encountered up there, that's anyone's guess, but it's my belief that in part Richard Hoagland probably is on to something, that we encountered artifacts. It's well known that the Russian space probes photographed some very anomalous structures on the moon surface, arranged in a very geometrical pattern. So at the very minimum, I think that we encountered something that indicates that the moon, if not inhabited now, at some time was, and that this is part of the exercise, if you will, that NASA is trying to suppress this information. And there's no doubt in my mind that there's also some collusion with the Soviets in this regard, because, of course, the Russians sent numerous probes to the moon, and they would have seen these things as well. So we're dealing with, to borrow the phrase of Stanton, we're dealing with kind of a cosmic Watergate here. It's a cover-up of massive proportions. Now, if we extend the speculation a bit more, it would not be implausible, to my way of thinking, that we may have encountered some force, some strange or alien or exotic craft out there that basically warned us off the moon, and there are, in fact, as you know, people that speculate that this is, in fact, why we've never gone back. So I would agree with you, and I think that Mr. McKinnon may be onto something, quite frankly, in his hacking enterprises.
Well, let's now go to the Bell itself and the object and the technology behind it. Now, first of all, when I was reading your description of the Bell, I was very struck by two things that we will get into over the course of the program.
Right.
One is its relationship in the way it was described to the power supply of the Vimana aircraft that are described in ancient texts from India. And second is something I built as a child, which I described in the secret school that the visitors gave me plans to build, which I later burned down my house with, but that wasn't unusual. I may have burned it down more than once, but in any case, the description of what I built and the way the Bell functioned were bizarrely similar. Now, why don't you tell us first what the Bell was?
Well, the Bell was, it's called the Bell because it was shaped like a bell. It stood about 8 to 9 feet tall and about 4 to 5 feet wide. It was cased in a ceramic material. Inside of this device, there were two counter-rotating cylinders into which they put a serum that is codenamed in the German records of the time, Serum 525. No one really knows what it is, but it is suggested that it was some compound of mercury and other elements, and I speculate that they were probably radioactive. Now, these two cylinders spun the mercury at very high rotations, and then apparently, in my thinking, probably pulsed it with very, very high voltage direct current pulses. And the purpose of this spinning and pulsing was probably to zero out the magnetic vectors of this spinning mercury, which would have rendered it a plasma in the electric pulse. Now, most physics that I have read would seem to indicate that they may have achieved some very dramatic anti-gravitational effects with this device.
Could it also have involved movement through time?
Oh yes, very definitely. Any time we're dealing with gravity, we're dealing with time. So that's also very possible. And in fact, it's good that you point that out, because one of the code names of the Bell that Germans gave it was Project Kronos or Project Time. So,
and Tor, the gateway.
Yeah, the gate. The Tor is another project code name for the device.
We're possibly talking then about a functional stargate.
Possibly, very possibly. We really don't know all of the things that there are to know about the physics of the Bell. I try and reconstruct it as carefully as I can, based on the evidence that we have.
Now let's flash forward to two things. Folks, there is so much to go here. I'm thinking that maybe we'll even do two Dreamlands. But in any case, let's flash forward to a couple of things. First, the Kecksburg UFO incident.
Right.
It's an object that looks just like the Bell, as you describe it, or very similar.
Right.
Second, the Betty and Barney Hill case. There are apparent SS officers on the craft, and they are interested in these people and seem to be interested in their interracial marriage. And there is a whole sub-literature within the close encounter experience of the visitors taking a special interest in interracial marriages, something that would have been very much of concern to the Nazis. I'm just going to let that kind of filter in and let you add those elements in your response.
Well, the Kecksburg UFO case is intriguing to me because every description that researchers, and primarily the research of Stan Gordon, who's made it kind of his bailiwick within ufology, most of the witnesses that he has interviewed have described a shape of the object that crashed at Kecksburg in very similar terms and even very similar dimensions to the Bell. But additionally, it gave off a distinctive sound, which is similar to the sound that's described as being what the Bell gave off when it was in operation. And additionally, I think the thing that's the dead giveaway, that something crashed there that may have been a similar technology, is the rather swift arrival of the American military on the scene to requisition the object and cart it off and sequester it in secrecy. So I think that probably there are too many connections between the two objects to suggest that they may not be the same thing. I think, in fact, that they are a similar technology and that somebody in our military and space agencies knew exactly what it was. Now,
let me ask you this. Could it have come forward in time? Could it have been from 1945, the object that hit in Keksberg? I know you've gone through this in Reich of the Black Sun to an extent, but let's hear the answer again.
Well, speculating again, if the Germans were successful, and I think all options are that they were, in the Bell as being an anti-gravitational device of some sort, if they were successful, then at the same time, any manipulation of gravity is simultaneously a manipulation of time. I mean, we know this from general relativity. So the point is it's very possible that it may have just simply got loose from them. I don't personally think it did, but it may have gotten loose from somebody at some later period and then popped up later at Keksberg. So I don't discount the fact we're dealing in areas of physics that are so off the books that once we open the door to anti-gravitation, then we have to accept the other. So I would have to accept that as a plausible possibility.
So in other words, now not only do we have to worry about Muslim terrorists, but time-traveling Nazis.
Well, you know, it's interesting.
Which sounds ridiculous, but the evidence is there, right?
Well, it's very interesting that Dean Koontz, the popular author of thriller novels, wrote a novel called Lightning. And it is all about a top-secret German project, and the descriptions in the novel of the device that they're testing and using for time travel are remarkably similar to the Bell. And it's made even more remarkable because Koontz's novel appears prior to, by several years, any actual factual research on the Bell itself. So, he makes the whole basis of his novel that the time-traveling Nazis are going forward in time to procure necessary technology to help them win the war.
You know, so, I have to say, just interjecting, that I don't know Dean Koontz, but I do know that process. And I have had, in many times in my career as a novelist, the experience of writing things that later turned out to emerge as true.
Right.
I had no idea how I had done that. But there is an explanation for it in the physics of consciousness, I'm sure.
Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
He's the type of guy who might very well have linked up to material that's out there in the ether. So what's the name of that novel again?
It's a novel called Lightning.
Lightning, probably. I've read Lightning, and it is now that I think of it, it is eerily, eerily connected to this. You're quite right. Startles me when you say that, because I hadn't thought of it. And in this startled state, I am going to have to tell you, folks, the sad news that we're going to take a little break. We'll be right back. We're back. We're talking to Joseph Farrell, his website, deathstar.com. How you ever got that particular name out of the Internet, nobody had grabbed it before you came along, I don't know, but it's deathstar.com. I'm sure you won't forget it, folks. Contains a little bit of more information. If you want to get the SS Brotherhood of the Bell, the place to do it is the unknowncountry.com store. Great prices, great service from Al Harlow, personal service. It is not all automatic. If something happens, you can write Al, and he will personally intervene to help you. But nothing much ever does go wrong with the unknowncountry.com store, because they are terribly efficient, terribly efficient. SS Brotherhood of the Bell. This is one I would not miss, absolutely not miss. First of all, it's a heck of an adventure. And second, it just, let me go now to the back to the working of the Bell. And Jim, you're going to jump in as soon as this is finished, because it's really Jim's turn at this point. And it has to do with this thing that when I was a boy, about 10 or 11, I had a close encounter experience that I thought of as a dream at the time of spacemen. And they showed me how to use two electromagnetic magnets, one donut-shaped and one round one inside the other, and to have them their polarities be opposite and turn them both on at the same time. And this supposedly would have enabled us to make an anti-gravity machine. Myself and a friend scrounged up such electromagnets, which his father being a pilot, we had fairly ready access to, more or less cobbled them together in my bedroom, plugged it all in. The thing made an eerie buzzing noise, which I think we will talk about and in a moment. Immediately thereafter, the house lights pulsated and went out. All hell broke loose downstairs, because in my family, when the lights went out, there was no question whatsoever in anybody's mind as to why that had happened. I was instantly in deep trouble. We hid the thing in the closet and got the lights back on again. But that wasn't the end. That night, the entire electrical system of the house started pulsating about 9:30 at night. Pulsated, just with the lights pulsating off and on, and they didn't flick off and on. They went down to very dim red dots and then back up again. And of course, mother and dad were after me with clubs. I mean, they were really furious because they thought I had done something to the house power, which they were right. The next afternoon, the whole place burned down, starting with the under the roof where the power lines came in. And, okay, obviously I did something that really screwed things up royally. Now, I want you to tell us how the bell worked in terms of the way it apparently used electromagnetic energy.
Well, we can kind of start with your experiment. It sounds to me like what you were doing was something close to vector zeroing all the lines of force of the two counter-rotating magnetic fields. And this is exactly what the bell was up to. I think a careful examination. The man who headed up the project was a Nobel Prize winning physicist by the name of Walter Gerlach. And his specialty in physics was spin polarization, magnetic field separation, and gravitation. So I think what he was trying to do was to create a kind of a magnetic bubble around this device, in which local space-time curvatures would become so radically altered that it would exist in its own kind of little space-time bubble. So I think what you probably did with your experiment was something very similar to what the Germans encountered, and the kind of effects that you got from it are very, very similar to the effects that I describe in the SS Brotherhood of the Bell, because there were power outages in surrounding communities, light bulbs were blown out, things of this sort happened. So the Germans were dealing in an area of physics that relied on the idea of vortex mechanics more than relativity to achieve these locally engineerable space-time bubbles. And this is, in fact, what I believe minimally the bell represented. So the bell is really kind of a device that, for want of a better expression, we can look at as a device of a kind of a unified physics. They could have accessed anti-gravity phenomena with it. They could have accessed time displacement phenomena with it. It could have been weaponized in a variety of very frightening ways that I describe in the book. So it's a very, very powerful
device.
Tell
us some of the ways it could have been weaponized.
Well, one of the things that I go into is you mentioned the sound. The sound of the bell, the Germans also called it die Bienenstock, or the beehive. And it gave off a characteristic buzzing sound. Now, in my mind, that sound is very characteristic of a high-voltage direct current switch being rapidly opened and closed, very similar to the type of sound that Tesla got during his famous Colorado experiment.
That was the sound our little thing made. It was very distinctive. It was exactly
right.
Like the sound of a hive full of bees that were really, really angry.
Right, exactly. And I think the Germans, by rotating this radioactively doped compound of mercury, I think probably what they also discovered is very, very high gamma emissions. Now, very late in the game in American nuclear weapons research, physicists discovered that they could achieve a gamma ray laser by pulsing gamma ray sources acoustically and in resonance with those sources that would cause a photon cascade, much like an optical laser that would issue in a coherent beam of gamma rays. Well, I think the Germans discovered some similar phenomenon by pulsing this radioactively doped isotope of mercury. So that's one way that it could have been weaponized, and there are any number of others. I get into a description of what I believe the scalar physics component of the Bell may have been. And, of course, once we open that Pandora's box, then we are truly, truly into weapons potentials that would make a hydrogen bomb really look like a firecracker. It's very frightening stuff.
And, Jim, now we get into the question of just how deeply penetrated these people, their power intact, may be in our world as we are living it today.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. This is something that is of intense interest to myself. In fact, I'm working on this as a project right now. And it is amazing when you look at some of the public persona that we have today and we see their connections. For example, it's been well established that Prescott Bush, the patriarch of the Bush family, was prosecuted in, during the war under the Trading with the Enemies Act as being nothing but a financial front man for Hitler and the Nazis. Then we found out that Bush's brain, Karl Rove, his grandfather was a Nazi Gauleiter. In fact,
now, Jim, that's been disputed.
Well, that's been disputed, okay. But then we also know that Arnold Schwarzenegger, who's now the governor of California, was close friends with Kurt Waldheim, who was fired as president of Austria because he had lied about his wartime experience, and they found out, indeed, he had been a Nazi official. And I think it's also very been documented that Schwarzenegger's own father was a Nazi Gauleiter, a party official. So we've got these direct lines to the Nazis. But I'll tell you another thing that Joseph brings up in his book, SS Brotherhood of the Bell, that gets close to my bailiwick, of course, is the Kennedy assassination.
Oh, boy.
And I think, and that prompted me to recall that I have copies of some letters that Jack Ruby smuggled out of the jail over in Dallas before his untimely death. And he, of course, was Jewish in background, and he said, who would have thought they were all Nazis? And so, you know, I think there's a lot of pieces here that are coming together. This separate space program. In the book, Joseph makes the point that it was perhaps that this Nazi underground was using both the Soviet space program and the United States space program to compartmentalize their research into this exotic technology, and all of a sudden these pieces start coming together. We know that in November, early November 1963, just prior to his assassination, President Kennedy had sent a lengthy memo to James Webb, who at that time was head of NASA, and told him that we were getting ready to go into joint space exploration with the Soviets. This, of course, could have caused a huge problem to this compartmentalization of this Nazi program, if it is as Joseph outlines. And so all of a sudden these things are coming together and a lot of things are making sense. For example, being a lay World War II historian, I never could quite understand why that Patton's triumphant Third Army did not just swing to the north and go straight for Berlin. Instead, he went for Prague, Czechoslovakia, and it never seemed to make any sense until we found out that Prague was the center point for this work on the Bell, the flying saucers, and the exotic technologies the Nazis were working on. Isn't that right, Joseph?
Oh, absolutely. There was headquartered inside the Skoda Works, the old Austro-Hungarian munitions works at Pilsen, which is a little city just to the west of Prague towards the Austrian border. The SS had headquartered basically a secret weapons think tank, for want of a better expression, inside of the Skoda Engineering Division at Pilsen. And this think tank was so well organized by its superior, General SS General Kammler, that it circulated its own private top-secret scientific journal. He recruited scientists from all over Europe and Nazi Germany, and he essentially freed them from the constraints of Nazi Party ideology and told them to brainstorm their ways to first, second, third, and even fourth generation technologies and to work out the basic technology trees that they would need to get there. So this was a massive operation, and just to kind of put the icing on the cake, what I think all of this points out or spells out is if one combines the Bell with their probable successes in atomic research that have been very, very carefully suppressed, and in addition to all of their success in some very radical miniaturization technologies, digital computing, so on and so forth, I think what it spells is really that Nazi Germany had a very covert, very large, Manhattan-sized project investigating all avenues of quantum mechanics that could lead to use of the zero-point energy as a practical energy source and as a practical weapon. And I think ultimately this is the reason that so much of this Nazi technology remains suppressed to this day.
Why is it, Joseph,
we need to take a little break here, and we'll be back with Jim Mars and Joseph Farrell in just a minute. We're going to be addressing the question, if that technology is still around, where is it, and how is it being used? In space? Is Gary McKinnon right? We'll be right back. This is Whitley Strieber. It's Dreamland. I'm talking to Joseph Farrell, his website, deathstar.com. Jim Mars's website is, Jim, what is your website address?
JimMars.com.
Of course. You're talking about feeling like an idiot, folks. Okay. JimMars.com. And the reason I was confused is that Jim has an email address, the real Jim Mars.
Right.
And, so I was confused about that. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. Jim Mars is talking. We're talking to Jim with Jim Mars now also. And Jim, you were just starting into a question. Why don't we continue from there?
Yeah, I just have this one question for Joseph. If I think I know the answer, but I want to hear what he has to say. And that is, if the Nazis had workable exotic technology such as the Bell towards the end of the war, why did they not use it to try to win the war as Hitler had predicted?
Well, I think there are several explanations. The first is that the Bell gave off some rather strange and very toxic field effects, and it was only late in the war that all indications are that the Germans were rather successful in controlling some of these effects. So that might be one explanation. The other explanation is that the Bell represented the pinnacle, really, of Nazi science and technology, so much so that they classified it higher than any other secret weapons project in the Third Reich, including their atomic bomb. And I believe that one reason they didn't use it is at that point, so late in the war, it would have been very useless, really, to them. So they, I think, took the decision to preserve that technology and most likely to continue to develop it either quasi-independently in some host country or altogether independently in some secret base somewhere, because it represented such a radical new departure in physics and technology.
Isn't it probable that they would have used that as a bargaining chip to ensure their continuation on after the war?
Sure, that's very, very possible. If it was to the point of being operationally deployed, then certainly it would have been a bargaining chip. They could have said, hey, look, leave us alone and we won't use this stuff and we may give you some little tidbits or crumbs from the table that it represents. So I find that a very possible scenario. The other possible scenario that I explore in a little detail in the book is that it may have ended up in some American Black Projects program where they continued to develop it using American taxpayer money. So, you know, funding was never a problem for them.
It's just tax money, plenty more where that came from.
Right.
I know that in my book, Alien Agenda, when I discussed the Nazi UFO programs and stuff, I know that this SS General Kammler that you mentioned, who was in charge of all this exotic technology, told the German scientists that he was going to hand over the V-2 rockets and themselves to the Allies, particularly the Americans, in exchange for immunity, and yet he disappeared, and we just kind of got hold of the V-2 technology when we overran their base in southern Germany. So isn't it possible that he decided that the Bell technology would have been a much larger bargaining chip than the V-2 rocket?
Oh, definitely. And in addition to that, it's little known that Kammler was put in personal charge by Martin Bormann of a special Nazi evacuation command that included the Luftwaffe Kampfgeschwader 200. Now, this was a special operational detachment of the Luftwaffe that had control over all of Germany's ultra-long-range heavy-lift aircraft, like the Junkers 290 and the Junkers 390. Now, the Junkers 390 was this massive six-engined aircraft. It was one of the first operational aircraft in the world to be outfitted for mid-air refueling, but it really wouldn't have even needed that because it was capable of nonstop flight from Europe to Argentina. So it's very interesting that at the end of the war, the Bell goes missing, all of its project documentation goes missing, General Kammler goes missing, and one of these massive Junkers 390 six-engined aircraft also goes missing after its last seen, coincidentally, in Prague. So the speculation is, and I believe it's a very sound speculation, that Kammler took this project at the behest of Martin Bormann and secreted it out of Nazi Germany to who knows where. There are really only two possible likely avenues that it went. One would have been to this country, where Kammler and the Bell disappeared into our own black projects, or it may have made its way down to Argentina, where it was developed independently by cadres of Nazi scientists that had sought the protection and obtained the protection of the Perón government.
And there was a laboratory devoted to this down there.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Oh,
tell us about that.
Well, General Perón had built for these Nazi scientists in a province of Argentina known as Bariloche, close to the Chilean border, had built for the Nazi scientists a large plasma physics and high voltage laboratory. And this was for the day a very, very modern laboratory, probably built to German specifications. So, you know, they had this laboratory there that they were experimenting in all sorts of high energy plasma physics, which the Bell certainly utilized. So that would have been a very likely home for it, and there is a certain amount of evidence that I present in the SS Brotherhood of the Bell that suggests, from Argentine sources, that this Junkers 390 actually made it down to Argentina and along with the Bell and disappeared into this laboratory facility where it continued to be tested by the Germans.
Wow. Yeah. Can you stay for an additional segment, an additional 12 minutes?
Oh, sure.
How about you, Jim? Can you hang in there?
Oh, this is too good to let go of.
I know it. That's my point. So, folks, we're going to be going on. Dreamland will continue on in with an additional segment. But before we break, I want to ask you this, and that is to get back to the possibility that when they made the breakthrough, and maybe they did make a breakthrough into anti-gravity, they ran into somebody, maybe somebody more powerful than they are, who could control them. And maybe this is the explanation for the odd behavior of the Nazi, apparent Nazis on the ship that Betty and Barney Hill encountered. Joseph, how do you react to that as a possibility that they really came up against a larger force when they developed this technology?
Well, I don't talk about that possibility in the SS Brotherhood of the Bell, but...
But I was asking you how you reacted to it, because I know you must have an opinion.
Well, I entertain the possibility is probably very strong, and the reason being that my own researches into this physics, which also includes my pyramid books, has convinced me that at some point, and again, Peter Lavenda has written about this in history books with Wolfgang Pauli.
Yes, and folks, Peter Lavenda and Joseph are going to be talking together for our subscribers at some time in the fairly near future. That's going to be a lot of fun, but go ahead.
Well, I think the possibility exists because this physics seems to present the picture of a common underlying substrate that is proper both to matter and to energy and to mind or to consciousness. So I think that it's very possible that in experimenting with this device, they may have opened up a gateway, all right, but they may have opened up a gateway to forces and entities that probably took them very much by surprise. And the connection that you made to Betty and Barney Hill is very interesting because I cite the section from the transcripts that Dr. Simon made with Barney Hill under hypnosis, where he describes the beings that he encountered as Nazis, and those were his words, and that kind of took me aback, because it indicates that perhaps there's an agenda, at least in some contactee and abduction experience, that has a dark and sinister purpose, and that he would have identified it in that fashion, I think, is even more illuminating. So they may very well have opened up some sort of door. I don't close my mind to that possibility at all.
Well, neither do I. And my own close encounter experiences, by the way, there's never the faintest suggestion of anybody like that involved. Certainly no Nazis were running around, but that was not necessarily true in my childhood when there were paperclip scientists living in a group on a street immediately next to our street. And my father was friendly with the FBI agent who oversaw them, who lived literally across the street from us. Also living there was the former base commander of the air base where the Mantell incident had taken place, where the pilot had flown into, tried to chase down a UFO and had crashed under bizarre circumstances. So it was pretty weird place, and I was obsessed with Nazis as a child, and because of the presence of these people, to the extent that my dad had to get a concentration camp survivor complete with the tattoo on his arm, who came over one afternoon and very gently explained to me what they were really all about and what had happened to him, and it changed my whole life, because what I had seen as a wonderful, dramatic, exciting thing had changed it. He revealed it for the monstrosity that it really was. And Joseph, how do you feel about that? Do you feel that there is a strain, I know Jim does, obviously, of actual Nazi power still very much alive in our government? And if so, is there anything we can do about it?
That's an excellent question, and to be quite forthright in my answer, yes, I do think that there is such a strain alive and well. What can be done about it, I think, first of all, is simply to be aware of all the ramifications of what we've been talking about with Paperclip and with the CIA and the technology and with the importation of German military intelligence as basically the operational Soviet desk in the beginning. This means that there has always been a kind of a rogue element in American intelligence, and many authors have commented on it, but none are really too certain where it ultimately stems from. And I believe that by taking this ideology, both in terms of the science and in terms of the politics into the bosom of our national security establishment, we in essence created this rogue element, and it's never really been adequately identified for where it came from, and that's Nazi Germany, and never owned up to. I think the only person that really tried to own up to it publicly was probably President Eisenhower in his farewell speech about the military-industrial complex. And most people think that he's talking about the good old homegrown American military-industrial complex, but I think a man of his wartime experience and his literacy, that he was really trying to warn us of another danger that lurked inside of that military-industrial complex, and that was the Nazi military-industrial complex and its horrible ideology. We see the slide of American morale and morals since the end of the war, and doing some unspeakable experiments on our own citizens. So I think the thing to do is just protest loudly and vigorously against this activity whenever one encounters it.
We'll be right back. We're going to continue, and Jim Mars is loaded for bear. You'll hear why in just a moment. This is Whitley Strieber and Jim Mars. We're talking to Joseph Farrell about the Nazis and their lost, hidden, underground post-war technology and their post-war power. It's really, really fascinating stuff. Joseph's website, deathstar.com, Jim's website, jimmars.com. You can get the book from the unknowncountry.com store. It is really illuminating. It's very, very well done. There are lots of sources available in this area that are questionable, but what Joseph has done is very carefully find out and determine which are to be believed. Where are the original documents? What do we know? And has produced a document about a hidden technology that could be at the actual secret center of our world. And Joseph, what could it be doing now? I mean, if they've evolved this technology, God knows what we could just be pawns, actually.
Well, there are several avenues in answer to that question, and it's a superb question, and one of the most obvious would be that it is the technology at the core of any secret space program that our government or any other government may be running. The idea of chemical rockets that we've been using for show since the early space program really kind of pales into insignificance when one considers the implications of the Bell. So somebody has this technology. There's no doubt in my mind that whoever has it has continued to develop it and to perfect it. So that's one avenue. The other avenue is along the lines of weaponization. And I explore it at some great length, actually, in the book, how the Soviets developed this technology and weaponized it, how most likely the Germans were in pursuit of similar technology during the war, how it made its way ultimately to Brazil, where it became the locus of another weapons program. Just to give your listeners the idea of the power of this type of physics when it's weaponized. Again, my analogy is that it would make a hydrogen bomb look like a kitchen match. It's the technology that is capable, literally, of any number of applications, from weather manipulation to earthquake manipulation to emotional manipulation, disease induction, and ultimately is capable of a planet-busting potential. So it's a very, very deadly physics that the Nazis uncovered during the war.
Jim, how do you respond?
Yeah, well, first, let me blow you away, Joseph. The question that you pose in your book, and I think quite correctly, you said that probably the genesis of this exotic technology goes back to knowledge that the Nazis gained through occultism, okay, through artifacts,
right,
through ancient tablets and scrolls. We know they're looking for the Ark of the Covenant and everything else. And
right.
Then correctly, though, you say also through channeled information Right. And you track that back to, of course, the Vril Society, the Thule Society, and said they were all really offshoots of the old original Teutonic Knights.
Right.
Now, what you probably don't know, and this is what's going to put you on your chair. I hope you're sitting down. Dick Russell, who has written a book about the Kennedy assassination, in his latest edition states that he, according to U.S. Military documents, he found that Lee Harvey Oswald had been a member of the Teutonic Knights.
Oh, my word.
Good Lord.
Oh, my word.
It's a mind-blower. Now, what we're really talking about here is the manipulation of basic energy. And as
right.
modern quantum physics is coming ever closer to understanding, that everything in the universe, space, air, water, land, material objects, biological, we're all energy. We're all
right.
energy. And, of course, this leads us to the answer of how they got this information and how that Dean Koontz was able to pick up on the idea of time-traveling Nazis for his novel. It's the same mechanism that I found in researching the military's remote viewing program.
Right.
They are able to go out onto the energy grid, the unified field, as Einstein called it, and if you're sensitive enough, if you pay attention enough, you can pick up on these thoughts and ideas, which, after all, are nothing but energy.
Right.
Do you agree with that?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And it's interesting that you mentioned remote viewing. I kind of allude to this in both the Reich of the Black Sun and the SS Brotherhood of the Bell, that some sort of similar project appears to have been underway in Nazi Germany under the auspices of the SS to pursue some of these paranormal viewing techniques. So it would not surprise me that at some very deep level, some of the inspiration for this certainly probably came through that type of meditation, for want of a better word. You couple that with the pervasive interest in Germany culturally in any sort of Orientalism and Hermeticism and esotericism, and certainly that interest was very much an underground stream within German physics of the period. You couple all this together, and you have in the brains of a man like Walter Gerlach, who's a first-class physicist, you have the cauldron, I think, that's necessary for a paradigm-shattering sort of new approach to physics, which, again, I think the Bell has every indication of being.
Well, in my research into the Nazi UFOs, one theory is that they had captured a UFO at some point and had back-engineered it, just like people claim we've done here with the Roswell crash. But yet, I could never find the slightest shred of any firm evidence to indicate that they did get a piece of hardware like that. And
right.
so I, long before I read your book, Brotherhood of the Bell, I had kind of come to the belief that they were picking it up through remote viewing or channeled information or however you want to describe it, meditation, as you said.
Or occult actual, as you alluded to earlier, Jim, actual occult practices, because
right.
let's there's another code word for this project that that Joseph mentions in his book, Lanternenschwager, I believe it is.
The lantern carrier, or the light,
yeah, das
the light carrier. And who was the light carrier,
Joseph? Yeah, das Lanternenträger Projekt.
Yeah.
The German stands for the lantern bearer. And, of course, the allusion is to the people that used to go around and light street lamps before the age of electricity. But, and I'm really not the one that points this out, it's the Polish researcher Igor Witkowski, who points out that it might bear an occult meaning simply because the lantern bearer or the light bearer is a code name or kind of a metaphor for Lucifer, who is, of course, the light bearer, the demonic fallen angel. So, in one sense, one of the code names for the Bell Project would have been Project Lucifer. So again, you know, we go back to Whitley's question about if the Germans had perfected this thing, might they have opened the door to some sort of very evil and overpowering spiritual force? And the answer, again, suggestively from the code name, is yes, very much so.
Right, and I would add for those listening who think, well, that's kind of ridiculous and kind of snicker at that, I would point out that Dick Hoagland, and this has been confirmed, has shown that most of the NASA space shots, and particularly the Apollo missions, somewhere somebody set the time and dates of those launches to correspond with astrological alignment.
Right.
Which means it doesn't matter whether you believe in this stuff. Somewhere, somebody with a great deal of power does.
What?
Right. Right.
Jim, could you give us an example of that? I'm fascinated.
I'd have to go dig in my files. I just remember that Dick Hoagland came up, and he listed the launches of some of our major space launches.
Oh, I heard that. I heard him do
and
that.
And pointed out that, yeah. Well, and then I read a lengthy piece by NASA scientist who set out to debunk it. And yet he said, holy cow, he checked, and sure enough, they do all correspond to certain astrological alignments. So whoever is powerful enough to set the time and date of NASA space launches obviously believes that there is an important correlation with the alignment of the stars.
Well, another thing that Hoagland has pointed out to maintain that thesis, and I think that on his website these papers and articles that he's done over the years are kind of scattered around, but he's definitely done a lot of very detailed work on it. But the other thing he points out on many occasions when he's been on various radio shows and in his book, A City on the Edge of Tomorrow, I think is the name of it, is that many of the mission logos or patches themselves are suffused with elements of occult symbology and so on and so forth. And this is quite true. One doesn't have to look very far to find these things. And the other thing he's also mentioned on numerous occasions is the number of Freemasons that were actually in the early astronaut corps. So, you know,
I don't think there was a single one who went to the moon who wasn't a Freemason.
Right. I think that's correct. And Buzz Aldrin, if I remember correctly, took certain Masonic paraphernalia with him to the moon.
Yes, he was a big Mason, 33rd degree.
Right. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, when we add all of this up together and then we add the Nazis in the background of all of this, there is a strong prima facie case to be made that some of the aspects of the space program are doing ceremonial ritual magic on a cosmic scale. There's no other way to put it.
Let's talk, if we can, a little bit about the Nazis who were involved with NASA. Obviously, Wernher von Braun, but there is a much more sinister figure, Dr. Debus, Kurt Debus. Why don't you tell us a little bit about Kurt Debus and his involvement first as a convinced Nazi who was actually denouncing people to the Gestapo. Then he turns up. Where did he turn up?
Well, that's kind of that's a Pandora's box. Debus ends up as a director of the Kennedy Space Flight Center at Cape Canaveral during the Apollo missions. I even have a picture, kind of a famous picture of him in the SS Brotherhood of the Bell standing next to Dr. von Braun. Now, the interesting thing about Debus is that he's not a rocket scientist at all. And in fact, he's one of the leading scientists involved with the Bell because he's the man that designed the power plant for it. So this is a man whose specialty is in high voltage electric discharge measurement and pressure measurement. So nothing to do with rocketry whatsoever, unless we kind of throw out the bone that he was probably involved in designing some complex circuitry for NASA, but that's about all we can say, unless his presence there again may indicate the development of a hidden off-the-books technology that
but,
was involved.
Because he ends up now in an administrative role.
Right.
In an administrative role, folks, which means that he is responsible. He's the guy who is watching the flow of paperwork.
Right.
He's the man with his fingers in every pie.
Right.
And here he is. He's a scientist. He specializes in an area that's not even directly related to what NASA appears to be doing. But he ends up the head of the Kennedy Center.
Yeah.
I think you're right. I think you're looking at a situation where NASA is simply not what it seems to be, because this man's expertise is not apparently needed. And not only that, I mean, the guy is a Nazi.
Yeah.
A Nazi who we knew. His past was not unknown to the United States government.
No, of course not. The United States secured the services of an SS Colonel Osenberg, whose whole function within the SS was to draw loyalty profiles of various Nazi scientists. So, in other words, this man had his finger on every black project inside of the Third Reich, and would have known not only who was a loyal Nazi and who wasn't, but would have been in a very powerful position to steer certain personnel to the United States for the purpose of conducting an ongoing quasi-independent project run by the Nazis at American taxpayer expense. So in other words, I think you're right. Davis's presence at NASA, particularly in the position that he's in, indicates a very pervasive and powerful Nazi influence in the space early space program. That probably, and I point out in the book, James Webb himself was concerned that the Germans were exercising a little too much independence in the space program. So, you know, it's not anything that we were unaware of, it's just that we didn't really know what to do with it, because we were dependent on their expertise in so many ways just to get us there. So
We were dependent upon them for our intelligence on Soviet designs after World War II, and we, you know, but then again, as we discussed right off in the program, that was all coming down through Galen's Nazi organization.
Right.
You've got them on, you know, you've got both hands playing off against the middle.
Right, exactly.
You know, there's another twist here, and that is that Galen's organization was itself penetrated by the NKVD during the war.
Right.
And
yes.
was offering back to the Nazis, to the German army, very poor intelligence. And this operation was taken lock, stock, and barrel into our intelligence community, which is why when I was a boy in 1966, the CIA used to advertise in the Daily Texan and for recruits. And I and a friend of mine decided we'd love to be secret agents. We were totally innocent of any of this at the time. And so we recruited for it. My father had been quite involved in intelligence work and worked with the FBI during his life. And at the time, I didn't even know that. But very suddenly one day, he telephoned me at my apartment and said he would like to meet me for breakfast the next morning. And it was in reference to my CIA application. I thought, hey, cool, I've been accepted, and they're going to tell me it's what next secret thing I have to do. So I was pretty pumped. I go there, and there is this man who meets me, knows what I look like, and meets me at the door, and we have our breakfast and sit down, and he tells me that my father has called him about my application, which I never even mentioned to my father. And he wants to warn me to stay away from the CIA because it's penetrated by the KGB.
Uh-huh.
And it is dangerous to enter it, because I will, he said, if you're a loyal American, which I know you are, you'll end up dead. So I told my friend, my own friend, I abandoned my application immediately. It scared me to death. I told my other friend who had applied with me this story. He poo-pooed it and said it was all nonsense. And he joined it. He died at the age of 47, apparently assassinated after a short and difficult career in the CIA.
Oh, my.
I have to tell you, I'm taking this to kind of a larger scale, because who's behind the curtain? That's behind the curtain, fellas.
Right. Well, in intelligence
and
work,
the thing here is that everything we've been talking about, including Whitley's experiences, all coincides. It all locks together.
Oh, very definitely. You know, and the KGB, MKVD penetration of the Galen network is a very well-known and documented fact. So, in other words, we're dealing with multiple entities that quite literally, at the very beginning of the CIA, had deep penetration into American intelligence. So it's really a hall of mirrors that we're entering into. But
absolutely. And, Joseph, this may lend support to the idea you advanced in your book, Brotherhood of the Bell, that the Nazis were exerting control in both the Soviet space program and in our space program. And when you get into penetration of the Galen organization and you're talking about double and triple agents, then
sure,
information could be flowing both ways and could
right
have been manipulated by the Nazis.
Sure, exactly so. Exactly so. This was, you know, the Galen network was very adept at penetration of the NKVD, just as the NKVD was very adept at penetrating Galen's network. So
I think it ultimately became its own thing. In other words,
right,
it was very, very instrumental in the eventual destruction of the Soviet Union. There's no doubt
yes
in my mind about that.
Yes.
And yet at the same time, it was in control of the Soviet Russia division of the CIA,
yes,
which was in itself staffed by fundamentalist Christians,
yes,
who were recruited for the purpose, who did not inform the United States government of the coming fall of this of the Soviet Union because they couldn't believe it because it went against their belief that
right
that passage in the Bible about the battle between the eagle and the bear referred to the Battle of Armageddon, and so they didn't think it could
right
the Soviet Union could fall without a Battle of Armageddon. So
therein lies the pitfall of just blindly following any particular ideology.
Yes. Because there's somebody, my point I'm making is there's somebody who is manipulating all of these ideologies, who is manipulating
right
Nazism, who is manipulating the convinced communist, who is using the Christian fundamentalist
right
to their own ends. And their ends, it seems to me, are rather clear. They
mm-hmm
they go in the direction of capturing us and capturing away our freedom, bit by tiny bit
by
until
bit
we've got none
right
left. And how
right
do we fight this? This isn't human. This comes.
It's monstrous.
It's monstrous. And we, the Nazis touched it when they spoke of the Lucifer light. And
right
how do we fight this? We fight this by living lives of compassion and respect
absolutely
for one another and the God that made us. And that's what saps its power, no matter how sinister, how clever it is, in my
right
opinion.
Right.
Well, guys, you know, we've always heard of the struggle between light and darkness, okay? And everybody understands this. In my research, I came to understand that the struggle between light and darkness is the struggle between knowledge, light, and ignorance, darkness. And, of course, ignorance then produces fear. Fear produces hatred. Hatred produces violence. And so I think the answer to what do we do about all this is we need to read Joseph's book. We need to read Whitley's books. You read my books. You need to study and think for yourself and bring yourself into the light of knowledge.
And act accordingly.
Act accordingly. Act in such a way that one doesn't get caught in their dialectical traps.
Well, that's right.
And there
are dialectical traps, even the
right
dialectical trap of the conspiracy theorists, which
right.
None of us are, by the way, folks. You may this sounds like that, but I don't have real conspiracy theorists on this show because they have they suffer from disconnected paranoia. In other words,
it's
paranoia without any process. We're paranoid because we're seen.
It's a spiritual process.
We're paranoid because they really are after us.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the end game here, and to take away our freedoms, Whitley's right, Joseph's right, but the end game is world domination. That's what Hitler and his Nazis proudly proclaimed, you know, they were going to take control of the world. Well, when the Germans lost World War II, then the Nazis had to retrench and figure out how they were going to do that again. I think they realized that the Soviet system of communism, that was really not going to work. And so I think they have been instrumental in building the United States into the technology and military supreme empire of the world. Now, if they can simply take over our empire, then they've got the world.
If you look
well,
at
I would.
Oh, go ahead. Let me just say this very quickly. If you look at it on the largest historical scale, you will find that there has been a long process of experiment dating back to the time of Egypt.
Yes, absolutely.
How do you control the human soul?
Right.
The latest efforts have involved Nazism, communism, and now this strange, unnamed thing that is eroding our American freedoms, but it's
right.
always got the same thing behind it. And never forget it, folks, anyone who goes after your freedom is on the side of darkness, period. Even
right,
no matter if they tell you how you need to give up some of your freedom in order to preserve it, they're still, that's where they are. Okay, go ahead.
Well, I would only add to that that it's really a spiritual phenomenon that we're talking about.
Exactly.
In
right.
all aspects of this technology, the underlying spiritual phenomenon is very clear. And it's interesting that you mention Egypt, because in my last Giza Death Star series book, I go into a kind of an extensive and very technical examination of some ancient Hermetic texts from the standpoint of physics. And what emerges from it is that there had to have been, at some point in the distant past, a very carefully and formally, explicitly elaborated science of consciousness that was very intimately connected to their understanding of physical mechanics. And Egypt is kind of the residue of this, so I couldn't agree with your observations more on that score. It's a very, very long struggle that we're dealing with here.
And we will win, folks. In a sense, we already have, because we know as much as we know now. I think that this program has been a very important one for you Dreamland listeners.
Yep.
Now you know something you didn't know before. I do, too. We've all come to a discovery kind of together, and I would like to thank Jim Mars very much for being with us. I would especially like to thank Joseph Farrell. He's doing terribly important work, SS Brotherhood of the Bell. Get it from the unknowncountry.com store. Visit his website, deathstar.com. Get into his other books and his other work. That's important stuff. Very, very important.